This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host, and I'm on the road today. I'm up in Kittery, Maine. It's next to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it's March 2022. This show will air in April of 2022. What can I tell you about Portsmouth and Kittery? Portsmouth, in my youth, was a salty seaport. There used to be an Air Force base, and there was a working Navy yard. You can imagine it was very diverse and thriving, all types from working class up. And now it's really become the center of food and drink in New England. To me, it rivals Portland and Boston. So we're in a very special place. I think I ran into a friend. He had some German brewers going up to Portland, and they happened to stop off here. And I'm in Tributary Brewing in Kittery, Maine, a place I've heard of for a long time. And I'm getting to talk with one of the brewers here. So he's going to introduce himself. He's a young guy who's worked in the business, and we're tasting some delicious beers, and we'll talk about beer styles as well. Woody?
Hey there, Jimmy. Woody Mott here. I am one of the brewers at Tributary Brewing Company, a disciple of the illustrious Todd Mott. He is my father, but, I'm trying to forge my own path.
Well, you sure are, man. I know that I had met Todd a number of years ago with one of his friends, and we're going to introduce some other guests later. But the whole point is, I'm up here at Tributary. This is a place when we're talking about, why craft beer, why on-premise, why draft, why beer styles. This is a great place to start. I walked in. It was everything you want. There was a really great little live music playing. The bar is perfect. I looked at the beer selection, and there was a range of styles. There was a Pilsner. There was a Porter, a Pale Ale, and some dark German beers. So I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm not leaving. We're going to hang out. So tell us about you, Woody. So you went to school. You were studying something, but eventually you worked in a brewery. So what were some of the breweries you worked in before you worked at Tributary?
So when I decided to move away from the finance field, it was right as Tributary was actually opening and, helping my parents set up, the few weeks prior to getting the show started, so to say. I elected that I didn't want to work in an office, and I wanted to work with my hands and create something that will truly make people happy, because I've seen the effects that has from Todd's years spent in the industry. So out of college, I decided to look around, see what I could get. Had a few interviews that didn't pan out, but I landed at Wormtown in Worcester. Hey, Ben, hope you're doing well, sir.
Love it there. Great place.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was a part-time work. I was living in Alston, Massachusetts at the time. This was 2015. And living in Boston, you need to make up those hours so you can afford to enjoy your time. So my second job I picked up shortly thereafter at Stoneface Brewing Company in Newington, New Hampshire. After a few months of splitting time between, living at the central point of Alston, going west to Worcester and coming north to New Hampshire, an opportunity came to my door that Stoneface was looking to, expand. And that meant they needed someone to pick up some cellaring work and devote more time in the packaging department. So I decided to go full time there. And shortly thereafter, I actually moved back up to the New Hampshire area.
Well, so much has changed in the last 15 years in the craft beer industry. It used to be that people were home brewers, started with a small system. But what were some of the tasks that you learned in those two breweries, Stoneface and Wormtown? I mean, you obviously still start by washing kegs, right?
Indeed. And I think my first day at Wormtown, we packaged 90 barrels of Bee Hoppy. And, not knowing too much about how to be a safe worker at that time, I threw my back out on the first day. But fortunately, at that point, I was young and resilient, and I made a comeback. But, it's just so important to understand, these very, jumping off points, you know, to get into the industry, you got to start with the packaging. You know, it's the most, I guess, forward way to understand, you know, importance of cleanliness, sanitation, you know, differing between, oh, what's a CIP with, you know, a caustic solution versus, you know, using acids to sanitize tanks, understanding what the finished product is supposed to be like and how to appropriately package that and get it out to the market. And so, you know, it was a crash course.
It's a lot more than just than brewing beer on my stove and wondering why it spoils.
Indeed. And I, you know, started home brewing when I was 21 on my 21st birthday. I got a very rudimentary kit and I made some god-awful beers. But, you know, it really makes me gain a lot of appreciation for those early steps that, you know, a lot of people in our industry tend to go through before kind of making the professional plunge.
Well, it's great. I mean, I came in and the first beer I'm having is a Pils. Tell me about the Pils, because we're going to talk about some beer styles today, too, because, like I said, you've got some dark German beers we're going to get to. You've got a Pils. There's a pale ale here that I've had several times that I really like. But let's talk about this Pils.
Yes, so we are drinking Nebenfluss, which is German it's not exact translation, but...
Wait, who's your friend? He just walked in on us.
Oh, hi, I'm Horst Dornbusch, and I was born in Düsseldorf, Germany, and my native language is German, and I've been in North America since 1969, and I just corrected my friend Woody's German pronunciation and translation. I apologize.
Well, it's great. Just that gives you a sense of when you walk into Tributary Brewing, you're going to run into some of the beer luminaries from the world, and he's the guy that was here with the German brewers, but we're going to get to him later. But Woody, Nebenfluss.
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 So, German for Tributary. Since Tributary's inception, you know, it's always been very important for us to put out a wide array of beers in our portfolio. That stems from Todd's time at brew pubs where, you know, having that home brewer mentality, he really elected to offer a wide array from, you know, styles native to the U.S., Belgium, England, Germany, Czech Republic, so on and so forth. And with that in mind, over time, we've kind of cultivated a repertoire of Pilsners. You know, we'll do a Czech Pils, German Pils, Italian Pilsner. We have an American style, all malted barley Pilsner that we brew as well. And it's, for me, it's just fascinating kind of understanding that the ingredients that we try to source from their kind of local or their primary locale, you know, whether it's the hops, the malt, and bring those in and utilize those to kind of embellish the greatness that, you know, a Moravian malt has versus one grown in Germany.
So I know you're really into the history. I mean, it was 2 years ago, Tom Acatelli wrote that great book about Pilsner, which I think told the story of, was it Bavaria and Bohemia? Did you read that book?
I haven't read it yet, but for the recommendation, I will certainly have to dig that out and give it a read.
Well, let's go into Pils. So there's so many different styles of Pilsner. I'm a little confused. Like last summer, I was really digging a lot of Italian-style Pils, and now you're telling me there's this German-style Pils. Do you tell me the difference between a couple of these different Pilsner styles, and then we'll ask our German friend here too.
He can correct me when I butcher the differences. But yeah, so Josef Grohl was commissioned by Urkel in the 19th century to bring modern lager brewing to Bohemia. And there, you know, he created Pilsner Urkel, and that revolutionized beer in Europe. And that quickly became the most popular beer on the market, and the Germans were scrambling like crazy to combat that that force coming from the east. And so they adopted, you know, the pale malt and followed kind of their traditional lager brewing techniques. But, you know, you have distinct differences given like water profiles, where water in the Czech Republic is very soft, but you have harder water in Germany. And because of that, German Pilsners tend to be a little more bitter and hop forward than the Czech variety. I believe that they are paler and more effervescent and dry in the finish. And so, you know, with those in mind, when Todd and I and other former disciples kind of come together, and sometimes Horst, we are lucky enough to have Horst chip into these ingredient making processes, you know, we want to kind of learn the history, do the reading, and between Horst's book, Beers of the World, as well as the Michael Jackson Beer Companion, we, you know, whenever it comes to Brew Day, I always read both of their takes on the beer that we're making. That really gets me jazzed, and I'm just excited for the Brew Day, and I have zero patience.
So there's classic styles, and yet there's hundreds of styles. One, you mentioned some people that have worked with your dad, Todd Mott. Who's the guy that opened up, is it Black Hog in Connecticut?
That's Tyler Jones. And Tyler, you know, I knew him as my dad's assistant. He was also my high school chemistry tutor. And, you know, fortunately, we met at the Jimmy LaPanza Lounge in Portsmouth Brewery. He was able to have a beer to help guide me through, you know, learning all about natural logs and how to apply that to balancing pHs and all that fun nitty-gritty stuff. But
I'm talking about brewing legends. I mean, we can talk about your dad. So, you know, we knew all these guys from the past and the future, Garrett Oliver and Brooklyn Brewery and so many others that we've interviewed on the show. But your dad really stands out because he's uniquely New England, isn't he?
Indeed. He's a Connecticut man born and raised. And, you know, he's an artist at his heart. You know, he got his master's in fine art at Boston University in pottery. He wanted to be a pottery professor. The, I guess, job market wasn't too hot for that back in the late 80s, but in that time, he also got into home brewing. And he, you know, hobby turned into a passion. The passion brought him into a career. And, you know, we can go on and on, but the rest is really history and well recorded already.
Well, and what just testament to this place now that your family has made, Tributary Brewing, is that I did walk in and our good friend, who to me is one of the esteemed, you know, German beer experts that we know of, is Mr. Horst Dornbusch, was just hanging out here. So we got him to come on the show. Horst, what is it about Tributary? Like, I think we first met together with Todd Mott many years ago at your house, and we did a great show. So just tell us about what it is about Todd and Tributary and why you're here today, too.
Well, Todd and I have worked together on several beers for maybe three decades. So we are some of the pioneers from the days of innocence when the craft brew movement started, and we have remained friends ever since. I deeply respect Todd and what he does. He is indeed a creative person. And in order to be a good brewer and a brewer who can make many, many different styles, you have to really understand both your ingredients and your processes. And that is much more complicated than a lot of people think. It's really, brewing is both science and art. You need to understand chemistry, physics, and actually aesthetics as well. And then you have to be able to control it from beginning to end. And this is something that Todd has acquired as a skill, as a complex skill for almost 40 years. And for that, I greatly respect him. And so I'm very happy to be his friend, and I come to Tributary very happily to taste his new creations and their new ones every time I show up.
All right, we're gonna keep talking to Horst as well. So Woody, what's the next beer you have? I love that you picked out four different beers for me to try. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to give you a broad array, a shining example of what you can kind of come to expect when you come to Tributary, because as I said earlier, we really want to have representation from all the great beer lineages that kind of have brought us to the contemporary craft brew scene. So next, we're going to be drinking our California Common, this guy here.
Cheers. Cheers. Well, again, you're talking me through styles. Tell me about this style.
So this is a favorite of mine. And, well, actually, I like a whole lot of styles. But when, gosh, I imagine Tributary was probably less than a year old, they decided to make a California Common. I think one of the former brewers, Jeff Goodnow, he brought the idea of making a Cali Common. So if you're not familiar with Cali Common, or California Common, it is a beer that, when the gold rush occurred out west, Bavarian immigrants moved that way, and they saw a opportunity to come and wet the whistles of those miners who were, you know, so diligently digging the earth and plucking the gold.
I saw it on your Instagram. So San Francisco grew from like a little village of 1,000 people to 100,000, all of them lusty and trying to get rich overnight.
Oh, indeed. They were a rough bunch back then, and being a rough bunch, they had to have beer to satiate those thirsts and, you know, relax at the end of the day. So, you know, the German immigrants that came, they brought their processes that, you know, they had acquired back in the old country. And because, you know, their yeast, the bottom fermenting lager yeast. But because out west, it's warmer than the caves in Bavaria, the yeast had to ferment at a warmer temperature. So the Cali Common, it is pretty much an amber lager that we ferment a little bit on the warmer side. And with that, you get a little bit more of a fruitiness from the fermentation profile.
So let me ask you something. I know Horace is here too. Is California Common, how is that different from a Kolsch in Germany? You want to tackle that? We'll get Horst on there.
It's, of course, an ale. It's a top fermented beer, whereas the California Common is a bottom fermented beer. So you have two different types of yeast. One is called Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the top fermenting yeast. The other one is called Saccharomyces pastorianus, a bottom fermenting yeast. The bottom fermenting yeast wants cold temperatures, but in California, before the age of refrigeration, you couldn't get cold. Cooling. So you were fermenting the beers at a temperature that was way too high for the yeast. And so the yeast mutated to adapt to its new environment, and it started to throw a lot of esters and fruity flavors. So this is basically a warm fermented lager, which is unique in the world because nobody in his right mind would ferment a lager at the high temperature that you normally ferment an ale. So that's why that beer is very unique. And also the grains are American barleys, sometimes six row barleys, but not always. And the hops, the traditional hops, would have been in those days the cluster, which is one of the earliest indigenous grown American hop varieties, which we think is a hybrid between British imported hops and one of the three American wild hops, namely the hops called Humulus lupulus neo-Mexicanus.
Okay, that's all right. Wait, you're good. This is like a treat that Horst is here. So basically, California Common was German brewers in California trying to make lager.
And screwing them up.
This is what came out.
Screwing them up.
Indeed. But
it became a style.
As the decades went on and we came into the 20th century, a lot of the breweries ended up closing down because the macro lagers that, you know, blew people away after the Prohibition kind of became the favored beer. But over time, you may know Anchor Brewing Company. They make their steam beer. So before it was called California Common, it was called steam beer. And Anchor trademarked that. And so for the rest of us who don't want to get a cease and desist, we refer to it as the California Common.
Okay, wait. So steam beer is California Common.
Correct.
Is there a Kentucky Common? And what about New York cream ales? Horst.
When The lager wave struck America in the second half of the 19th century. The East Coast ale breweries all of a sudden saw stiff competition coming up from the lager makers, and lagers started propagating from Philadelphia. The original lagers in America were made in Philadelphia, and they spread. So in order to compete with those new lager beers, the ale breweries in the East started to make a beer that was very pale, and often they mixed it. They mixed both ale and lager yeast merely in order to compete with the competition, but also in order to be able to use their equipment, which was really ale-making equipment and not lager-making equipment. So this is how the cream ale steel evolved.
I agree.
And that's pretty cool. So these are the things you learn when you come to Tributary Brewing. We're going to get schooled in beer history because, honestly, I'm going to say it, I don't like to complain, but with everything we went through the last couple of years, drinking so much beer in cans, I love being on-premise at a brewery, and I love the difference between different beer styles. So let's do the next style, because eventually we're going to get to some very interesting darker German beers that these guys have been working on. So we're not talking about anything that most of you care about, but I think most of our listeners, when you talk about rauch beers and you talk about dark lagers, I think that all of us that are listening now, those are beers that we like to drink. So let's go to the next beer.
All right, next up is our flagship pale ale, which is this one right here in the front. This is, 5.2%. Todd wrote the recipe in order for it to be a beer that you could drink any time of year.
Wait, so that's a recipe for Tributary?
Yes. So, well, American pale ales are obviously not invented by Todd Mott, but he knew that when he wanted to decide on what style of beer to kind of have as our flagship, everyone tends to jump on the IPA train, and he wanted something that was a little more sessionable, a little more approachable, and, has kind of the Todd Mott mark of, being bright, being balanced, not pushing the envelope too much of having an exorbitant amount of hops within it. He wants the malt backbone to shine through, and that's something that I take into consideration and really appreciate as well, because you can only have so many palate wreckers or beers that are in high ABV before you're feeling it, or you're feeling it in your stomach. And so he designed this just to facilitate drinking, and it's something that a lot of people in Maine and the Seacoast area have really grown to love, and we put it out in circulation as frequently.
Woody, I'll tell you, actually, last summer I was up in this area a couple of times, and some friends, I think this is how we got to connect. They talked about Tributary, and we were drinking the pale ale. And I find it's the right beer for me. When I walked in earlier, I went up to the bar and I said, I want the pale ale. So great job. Horst, Woody was talking about what Todd Mott's beers are, and he said bright. How would you describe them? Because you've known and worked with them a long time.
Okay. It's very easy to make an extreme beer, because behind the extreme alcohol, the extreme bitterness, or the extreme funkiness, you can hide brewing mistakes. If you're a really good brewer and you make a drinkable, well-balanced beer, then you have to really be a master of your craft, because if you're not, the customer can taste it and they won't come back. So his beers are not only bright, when the beer is not bright, but rather dark, or let's say very turbid, very fruity, excessively fruity, then you can hide bad quality behind it. The beer behind the extreme then can be not very good. However, if you are restrained and you create a balanced beer, that's very tricky, and that is what Todd knows how to do. That's where his craft shines.
And now, Woody, for you, you mentioned Weyermann beer. I think when I first met Horst, I don't know, 12 years ago, he was at Brooklyn Brewery with Garrett Oliver and the Weyermann people. Let's talk about that connection, because we always talk about ingredients and how important that is to the beer. So, I know you're young in the sense that you probably won't really know everything till you've done this about 20 more years. But when you think of Weyermann and the ingredients that you're working with, tell us what's in your mind about it. Like, is there a reverence? Do you respect it?
Well, it goes without saying that when I write recipes, I tend to always go for Weyermann products first and foremost. The quality is there. The variety of, you know, both base malts and specialty malts is unrivaled. And I was fortunate enough to visit their malting facility back in 2015. And, you know, seeing in Bamberg, Germany, seeing firsthand kind of just their methodical approach in, you know, harnessing the breadth of what malt can be and how that can be utilized in beer. And, you know, again, we'll be going, dropping Todd's name a whole lot, but, you know, when we write recipes, we don't want anything boring. We want multi-layered beers that, you know, not only are we going to use just one base malt, we use, you know, for the pale ale alone, we use four different styles of base malt. We have the Weyermann Pilsner, crisp best ale malt, raw two row, and some main grown and malted barley from Blue Ox up in Lisbon Falls.
I've actually talked to them a couple times on the show. And this year, the Craft Malt Conference was originally scheduled for Portland, Maine, and I was going to do you would have been invited, Horst, a tasting at the Novare Res of Maine malts and things. But we'll be back next winter. But so I got to talk to Joel from Blue Ox Malt. That's great. I mean, you got to work with a little local malt, don't you?
Oh, indeed. Yeah. So I'd say about 40% of our pale ale is the Blue Ox, and we love their dark wheat, their Vienna. So their take on Vienna malt is delicious and exquisite. Joel and the Davids are really doing a wonderful job up there. And I've gotten to go and firsthand see kind of the process. And, you know, they're doing floor malting as well, which is, you know, a testament to their respect for tradition and integrity of, you know, the final product and how that can be utilized for breweries in Maine and beyond.
Okay, let's talk about beer recipes. So we got Horst here, who wrote one of the book. I think also I met him through the Oxford Encyclopedia of Beer many years ago, and this guy did do most of the writing and editing, just so you know. But I'm going to talk instead of Horst.
Let me remain humble.
You're humble, trust me. but I like to talk about, when I think about craft malt now, I think about how that ingredient can influence your beer. Like we talked about the different types of German or Italian pilsners, that the hops might influence that profile. Do you see a beer that you might make that could be influenced more by Maine malt? I mean, do you think that, like the same way we talked about the California Common was a response to the climate and the yeast in San Francisco, do you see something come? I would like fantasize. Do you see a Maine malt profile beer coming?
So I guess it should go without saying that at the annual hop harvest in Gorham, Maine, every year at the hop yard. Yeah, that's the one. We make our all Maine indigenous wet hop beer. So we're using exclusively Blue Ox malt varieties for the grist bill. And then, you know, we typically get about 100 pounds of fresh Cascade as well as 20 pounds of Comet.
Wait, so that's something that, what time of year is that and when can I get that beer?
So typically that's the last week of August or the first week of September. It all depends when the hops are ready, because obviously you don't want to push the envelope and harvest too soon.
It, but it's not ready yet.
Yeah, so that's when we make it. Indeed. Thank you for pointing that out, Horst. So typically that one is actually, because we don't do any dry hopping or anything, it goes through a process in which we utilize our Lauterton as a kind of false bottom for which the beer from the whirlpool will go through to extract, the hop oils. And then we have a hop back as well that we can fit about 50 pounds into. So we'll have it go through that right before going into.
So it's an all main beer.
An all main beer. Minus the yeast that we source from Belgium, I believe. But,
stuff is in, the company is in Lille, but they make it in Ghent in Belgium, the yeast.
Well, this is fun. So I walked in here again, Tributary, and I'm sitting not only with Woody, one of the main brewers here at Tributary Brewing, one of our friends and beer experts, Horst Dornbusch, is also here with some German brewers. So this is quite a day for me. And it tells me a little bit of the magic of this Kittery, Maine, which is really like Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's a very neat place. If you're ever going up to Portland, Maine, you got to stop here first. And this seems to be like the new crossroads. And I think I'm going to come up here whenever I'm in the area. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. You can become a member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. And there's a big push going on now for the business memberships. If you're a business, there's a lot of opportunities to advertise on air, just like you would on other public radio networks. But check us out, heritageradionetwork.org/biz, and you get to know some of the great people that work on this network. So, wow, Tributary Brewing. I'm finally here in Kittery, and I walk in. There's Woody Mott, who's one of the brewers, and Horst Dornbusch. Horst, it was like 7 years ago, I was up in Massachusetts, and you said, come to my house. We're going to have dinner. You're going to meet this guy, Todd Mott. And we had a wonderful show. Do you remember that show? Like that you were just introducing me to them. So tell us about that night and why you love this brewery.
Well, Todd understands the concept of terroir. Every ingredient is grown in a particular place and thus is very different, even though the brand name or the variety name is identical. A Tettnanger hops grown 10 miles south of the Canadian border in northern Idaho at Bonos Ferry tastes very different from a Tettnanger grown on the eastern shore of Lake Constance, where it originates. Hallertauer from Bavaria tastes different from a Hallertauer grown in Australia, and so on. So, in other words, if you need to understand your ingredients, and you have to use great ingredients. In other words, you cannot make a great beer from crappy ingredients. You can make a crappy beer from good ingredients, but you can only make a good beer from great ingredients.
Of course, when I talk to you, I think about, it's like the professor who knows so much. Do you find that there's certain brewers that know every reference you're making, or do you feel like that they all need to learn more from you?
Oh, my God. I try not to be an elitist here, please. I think we have to be generally humble. There are always new things we can learn in life, in all aspects of life. So, I mean, in other words, your question answers itself. The answer is yes, of course.
All right. And then there's other things we're going to talk about later in the show. And let's do it now because I want to ask you. You mentioned with climate change that we depend on, forget water and yeast, but we also depend on grain and hops for the beer that we like. what's happening with climate change? I've never done a show about climate change and beer, but of course it relates to the ingredients. What's happening? It sounds like you're on the pulse of this.
Okay, I can give you one concrete example. One example. Germany produces 40% of the world's hops. The Hallertau region produces about 30% of the world's hops. So this is a huge amount of hops. So take that hops out of the market, and we have a deficiency of hops. We have a shortage. Now, there is a little thing called a citrus crack bark viroid. It's a virus-like thing that attacks citrus trees in Israel. It's harmless to the citrus trees in Israel, but it has migrated via Slovenia slowly to the Hallertau. It attacks the hop gardens, and there is no antidote, and the hop garden will die. And so they have to contain it now. They're burning down the hops. The fields remain fallow. It's something that has migrated because the climate has the temperature has risen by several degrees Fahrenheit in the center hop-growing regions of Germany, and the old land races, Hallertauer Mittelfrüh, Spalter, Hersbrucker, and Tettnanger, cannot adapt fast enough to the temperature rise. So the farmers get half the yield than they used to get. Plus, the hops are dying on the vine from new bugs, new pests, and the lack of moisture and the high temperature.
So we know, if you know about wine in the 19th century in France, there was phylloxera that kind of wiped out...
Phylloxera
that wiped out some of the French grapes, and they started using American rootstock. Correct. But also, New York State, you want to tell us about New York State in the 19th century? New York State was one of the greatest...
Cooperstown
and hops producers, and yes. He's going to coach me... in New York, and there was also, what was the infection, wasn't there an infection for New York hops in the 19th century?
I think it's what's called Verticillium wilt, and it basically killed off the entire production, and the entire American hop production was centered there, so the hop production had to move westward, first to Michigan, and eventually to the state of Washington.
So it just reminds us that so much of the good beer that we like is dependent on agriculture.
Oh, it's extremely delicate. If we lose the core areas of our agricultural resources for brewing and in hops, 40% comes from a very tiny area, roughly the size of Rhode Island in Germany, and another 40% comes from Yakima, the state of Washington, in the state of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. If we lose those plants, we lose almost all of our hops. This is one classic example, and there are analogous examples I don't want to get into now in the production of brewing barley. So this is very tenuous, and climate change is up, and we can't move the growing regions north because it has something to do with the exposure of the latitudes towards the sun, the angle to the sun. So we can't just move our agriculture north or south in the southern hemisphere. We have to stay where we are. So we have to adapt the plants to the new climate, and thus barley breeding and hop breeding right now is working furiously to allow us to continue to produce the volume of brewing raw materials at the quality that we are accustomed to, as well as the quantity.
And perhaps out there in Arizona, there's some wild hops growing that some of our friends are working on right now. Woody, how does it feel? So this Tributary Brewing in Kittery, Maine, you really are this pulse of beer. I mean, you're very humble, the fact that you've grown up around this and you're working in it. What's the hardest part of your job right now? I mean, do you have to, like, you mentioned something, we're going to pull something off a tank that Horace wants me to taste. What's that going to be? Because I don't want you to get up right now, but what's that going to be? And then what are you going to have to do with that tank tomorrow?
So I guess to kind of go full circle with what Horace was just talking about a month ago, we had Walter Koenig, who is the lead grower.
He is the general manager of the Hop Research Center in Germany. He is breeding those new hop varieties that defend the German hop industry against climate change.
And there, you're going to be using some of these new hops.
Yes. So, as I was saying, about a month ago, Horst and Walter joined us for a brew day. They had devised a Bavarian IPA. Tack another IPA on the board for the styles that it started, you know, time to jump on the bandwagon and enjoy. And for this first rendition, we're going to do this twice this year, you know, once in February. And then I believe we have it scheduled again for sometime either in the late spring or early summer. But we'll figure, pencil those dates in at a later time. But, you know, so for this first brew.
It's Bavarian IPA. That's what you're calling it.
That's what we're calling it. So it's using, minus the yeast and the water, all Bavarian ingredients. So we are utilizing Weyermann malt, as well as those hop varieties that come from the Hallertau region.
Those are the newly bred varieties, one of which isn't even available in the market yet. But Walter ships us test samples of those new varieties so we can play with them over here. And this is how we made the Bavarian style IPA.
Well, I know that just in your region, Notch Brewing, Chris Loring also, he seems to have, he's sourcing a lot of classic ingredients as well. Why Weyermann? So Weyermann's Bamberg, it must be important to trust where you get your ingredients, right? I mean, do you have to test every batch that comes in? Do you have to worry if this is going to gum up your fermenter or something?
So, to try to make a long story as succinct as possible, my understanding, and this is secondhand from Todd telling me this, in the 90s, the Weyermanns came to Boston for the Craft Brewers Conference. I think they were doing, as craft beer was just starting to pick up, I think they were seeing, you know, the writing on the door that they could finally make their splash. Because, and Horst, do correct me if I'm wrong, I think that they were having some financial difficulties prior to then.
I don't want to talk about that.
That's past history.
It was a small local malting company, and they had the vision to see that what they were doing for the small German market in Bavaria might have a chance here, and so they decided to risk expansion in anticipation of jumping into the American market, which was very unlikely. And one of the things about Weyermann is they have extremely rigid incoming control for the raw barley. So you can't make great malt from crappy barley. So they only select the best barley. And where they are located in Bamberg, this is one of the best barley growing soils in the entire world.
So Horst, they're a good, talk about craft malt. So Weyermann's a good model for American craft maltsters to look to?
Way back, they were basically a craft malting company, yes. And since then, they have expanded to become a global enterprise. However, they started very small, and they were always interested in super quality. And this is the philosophy that they have retained throughout the years as they grew phenomenally, yes.
So you're in good hands, Woody.
Absolutely. And just to kind of finish up that story as quickly as possible, Todd was walking around and checking out booths, and he went to Weyermann, talked to Tomas and Sabina. Yeah. And, you know, now 25 years later, they still are very close. And,
they're friends.
Yeah, the Motts and the Weyermanns and the Dornbusch families are all, good together.
Oh, great. So, and since you're talking about German malts and German beer experts, last summer, when I got to taste your Tributary Pale Ale, your dad actually brought me, it was like a rye Rogan beer that to me tasted like an Aventinus. And I know Aventinus has inspired you. Let's talk about that beer and what you like about it. Because I can tell you my story about an Oktoberfest in 2001, New York City, not too long after 9/11. And we had a crazy Oktoberfest with a live performing artist. I had 8 large bottles of Aventinus in one night. And I will tell you this, it was one of the greatest nights of my life. But so why Aventinus? Because that's why we're here today.
So I guess to kind of even preface my appreciation for Aventinus,
8% Doppel wheat Bock, is that it, Horst?
It's a Dunkelweizen Doppelbock.
Dunkelweizen Doppelbock. Can say that 10 times fast. Anyway, so to preface kind of my appreciation for Aventinus, having Todd, bring all these beer styles to Portsmouth Brewery and the other restaurant or bars, not bars, breweries he'd been a part of, one beer that I tried probably when I was 15 was a Hefeweizen. And the flavors from that just, were different from anything I'd had before. It brings something to the table that you just didn't find commonly around here at that point. And unfortunately, still, it's not common enough as it should be, but that's a discussion.
So last summer, I tried the rye, the Rogan.
So we called it Cultivator for short, but it was a Dunkelrogan Doppelbock. And to kind of...
Rye instead of wheat, right?
Rye instead of wheat. And kind of how we came to that, I want to first say that the Cultivator was the brainchild of Horst, Todd, and myself. I was drinking an Aventinus one afternoon in the summer of 2019, and we had just, our former lead brewer, Ian Goering, had announced that he's moving on. And Ian had kind of come up with the, for Tributary, we usually put out one Bock beer a year. And Ian had kind of created a Helles Bock that we'd brewed for a few years. And with him now moving on, I decided that I wanted to kind of give my or pay homage to Aventinus, and being a beer that when I was 19 years old, I was in Chicago at the Publican with my family having brunch, and I had it just had the most exciting description on the menu, and so I had to drink that. I ordered it and it blew my mind. Just the richness of the layers of malt character that it has, coupled with the Weizen yeast, it was probably the first beer that I felt was something truly remarkable.
Banana and fruity.
Yes.
So what's great is that this style can evolve, like dark wheat, box, lagers, all these things. I want to talk about the style because I think this is what brought me here, actually, was having that beer last year. And I want to say that to many of our listeners, you guys know different styles, and this is one of the greatest styles in the world. So, Horst, tell us about this style and the variations, because for many of us, we've had the Weizenbock, the Doppelweizenbock. I didn't know there was so much room to play with this.
Well, if you replace the wheat malt with rye malt, and you use a pale rye malt as well as a roasted rye malt, that is the real trick. Then you're creating a depth of flavor that is unsurpassed and really unique. And the Dunkelroggen Doppelbock, to the best of my knowledge, and you can go on the internet, it's the only place here where this is being brewed. So this was the first and only time that this beer style was actually implemented. And after the Roggenbock, German for spelt is Dinkel. So we decided to do a Dunkel Dinkel Roggenbock, and Weiermann offers not only a spelt malt, but also a roasted spelt malt. So we are doing basically an Aventinus, but instead of using wheat, we're using pale and roasted spelt malt. So this is what we got here today. That's what you just sipped.
So Woody, you got to make it easier on me. You got to rename this beer like the Woody Bock or something.
The Woodinator. We call it Dinkelator for short, and I think people are able to pronounce that one. But I was serving beer yesterday, and people will come up and they'll squint at the board and they'll say, "What is the Dinkelator?" And I tell them to brace themselves for what I'm about to lay on them, because it is a tongue twister in and of itself by name. So Dunkel Dinkel Doppelbock, and I can say that 10 times fast. maybe.
But don't.
Yeah, I'm not going to now.
We're getting somewhere with this. So everyone talks about craft beer. I love craft beer. I love being at a brewery. I love a place like this, a tasting room. I love experts coming through. This is like the crossroads of New England. But for different beer styles, I mean, there's so many beer styles. Like I'm sorry to my, you know, my daughter is almost 20. She's almost 21. Younger generation to know that there's so much out there for you, and it's really exciting. So, styles, Horst. I mean, we've already tried several styles here, but Horst, for you, how would you? You got new brewers and new consumers. You're on like a German TV, but English language, because for us, how do you describe just how many different styles there are? You just talked about in this dark beer just changing some of the malt bill.
Well, technically speaking, we shouldn't call it a style yet. It's a one-off, and we have to be honest. So you can make zillions of one-offs by just fiddling with the ingredients and the processes and the yeast and all of that, or the water, whatever, water treatment, filtering, not filtering. So to me, a style is something that is picked up by many, many breweries in a large area and is brewed over a long period of time. If it stands the test of time, then it becomes a style. So we should be honest, Woody. Really, the Dunkel-Dinkel-Doppelbock or the Dunkel-Rong-Doppelbock is not yet a style, but the Dunkel-Weizen-Bocken-Doppelbock a la Aventinos is a style because it has survived over such a long period of time. So that's how we want to look at it. And some of our creations may remain one-offs and interesting or not, but some may actually be path-breaking creations that will actually create a totally new experience for many people.
So you're around good people, aren't you, Woody?
Absolutely. I am surrounded by brilliant and those who are very well informed, and I take it upon myself to do the reading. I went to the American Brewers Guild, learn the nitty-gritty scientific side of it, because we can all go out there and learn how to do the brew process, but something goes wrong, or if you're thinking of how to devise a style, you have to understand the big picture and the little picture, because that will better inform us on how to tweak our processes to make a beer that is trying to encapsulate what we aim to.
One thing that I love about craft beer is that, yes, many of us are geeks, and we always want to try something different and new, but the key is that we want something good. And I've noticed we have an offshoot. My friend, Mr. John Hall, created a fun thing last year. It was called This Week in Rauch Beer, and he's got Camp Rauch Beer. So he's got a really great Facebook group, but everyone can talk about drinking Rauch beers. And I love Rauch beers, but what I want to tell you guys, if you're part of that group, is, well, the smoke malt is interesting, but what I'm drinking now is that there's so much potential with different malts, and that I'm going to encourage brewers to do it like you guys are doing, that it doesn't have to be small to stand out from hoppy. Right, Horst?
A Rauchbier can be very one-dimensional if you're using too much smoke or if you're using peat woods, a peat smoked malt, for instance. This beer is multi-layered. It's very differentiated. There is a subtle residual sweetness that is not cloying. There's a subtle hop bitterness that is high-quality bitterness. It's a smooth bitterness. There are multiple hop aromatics in there from myrcene, farnesene, linalool, and so on. So you get all the complexity, and this is what a great brewer can bring out, and that starts with the composition of the recipe. In other words, a bad composition will never sound great, even with the greatest orchestra. So that's how we compose these beers, like a composer. We take all the notes, and then we hope that the end result will be one pleasing whole that is wonderful. And that's what you're enjoying here.
And for me, way back when I started in beer, the Aventinus was my style. So Woody, what was it about that style that caught you? Because I think if you can appreciate Aventinus, you are able to appreciate the whole world of beer.
Absolutely. So when I drink it, it is a moving beer. You know, the layers of the malt character are just, you know, there's so much depth there between, you know, kind of the like caramel toffee character that you get from the dark malts. You know, it's not really roasty, but there's some like chocolate tones to it as well. And then, you know, you get just this very rich, I just call it malt character. And I think that is evident in the Dinkelader as well, where, you know, it tastes just like eating a fine roasted cereal, almost like something like that.
Okay, now we're going to go to another style. So I always wonder why people wait in line for a beer when they can find a really great brewery or pub and not have to wait in line to get a good beer. You know, your dad was part of this Imperial Stout. There was in New England, it was called Kate the Great, Portsmouth Brewery. I only learned about it probably from Horace a number of years ago. You guys have that same recipe. Just tell us that beer, when the release is, and what's so special about that beer, and why a stout? Like, I like pastry stouts. I like some of those crazy ones, but I don't really buy them. Is this a pastry stout?
It sure as hell is not a pastry stout. And for just to build off that.
Yeah, tell us the beer is being released in April. We know that, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here for the Dinkelader.
All right, so Mott the Lesser. It is the contemporary of Kate the Great. Portsmouth Brewery got to keep the name. Todd's actually been brewing this since the mid-90s down at Back Bay Brewing Company. And, you know, as the years have gone on, he's refined the recipe. It is kind of, I think, it reflects him as well because, you know, he's never fully satisfied with the end product. There's always something to that.
Imperial Stout, like, it's... Does it have to come on a boat from Russia? Does it have to be in whiskey barrels? I mean, it's not just a one note, is it?
No, it is a very multifaceted beer. And, you know, when it comes to milling in for that day, we have 21 malts going into it. And it is a beer that gets about 5 months of maturation for us. Half of that we'll keep in stainless. In one of our horizontals, and the other half goes into a rotating melange of barrels. So we'll always have port and Madeira. Those are kind of the staples that, you know, we'll always add.
Barrels.
Yes, port and Madeira barrels. Thank you for pointing that out, Horst. And then we kind of play around with the other two. You know, we may decide to kind of keep one from one release to another, and or we may decide to change them both up. So for the version that is coming up in a few weeks, Port Madeira.
What's the release date? Because this show will be airing the first week of April.
Ah, well, then all you listeners will have the opportunity to come get the beer on April 23rd. I believe we're going to probably package about 2,000 barrels, or 2,000 bottles. And, you know, we sell most of them on that Saturday, but we usually will have a few stragglers on Sunday. But April 23rd is the day. Mark your calendar and come hang out. We have a pretty exciting...
Are there pre-buys or do you just literally wait in line?
Well, during the pandemic, or traditionally, it was waiting in line. And the we have the best parking lot in Kittery. Everyone knows that. And so, you know, we'll have folks that show up usually between 6 and 7 a.m. And by the time we open at noon, the line is going around the building, kind of usually ends up where the post office is all the way down at the other side, about 40 yards away, I would say.
Wait, this isn't just lining up for the latest IPA release, is it?
No IPAs, just Mott the Lesser, and we release it twice a year. The people that search for this beer love the complexity that it brings to the table. You know, it's we only offer well, kind of our means of providing it to the masses is you get a wristband, and with that wristband you get two bottles, two pours, and then a pour of something else. And that way, you know.
Wait, so you can only get two bottles, but you can get pours of this beer on draft while you're hanging out too?
Indeed, yeah. So we bring in some tents. We have food caterers come, and we try to make a party of it. It's always a lot of fun. Todd and I will always be a little...
If I buy a beer, I got free food?
I wish. I think we have to pay those guys off, unfortunately. But we always have a porchetta sandwich guy come by that... he worked with Todd over at the Porson Brewery, and those sandwiches, they're meant to be drinking with a big, beautiful beer like Montelet.
And I have a smile on my face because, honestly, I've never waited in line for beer. I don't wait in line for brunch or restaurants or anything. I'm not a snob. I'm just like, there's so many great places to go. And this actually sounds like an amazing festival. Like, I got to come back April 23rd.
Well, I would be pleased to have you, and it'd be a hell of an opportunity to... drink one by your side.
Okay, so Horst, Todd the Lesser, this Imperial Stout. Talk me through the style, because I don't understand it. There's different blending. There might be some barrels from other years held back. This sounds like a very sophisticated drink.
Well, I think we can sum this up very generally. The beer changes from the bouquet to the upfront taste, to the middle taste, to the body, and then to the finish. It's almost like a different beer throughout the stages of your experience, your sensory experience on the palate. That's one thing. So you get incredible complexity, you get quality, and you get scarcity. So the people stand there because they get complexity, quality, and scarcity. That's why they stand there. And if somebody stands in line for just another hyped, overly bitter IPA, I don't understand why they do that. But then again, everything is distributed by the bell curve. And I think the people who stand in line here, they are at the right edge of the top quality of the bell curve.
Well, that's great. Well, Woody, one last question about Todd the Lesser and other of these Imperial Stouts. One, what's the ABV? And two, are you holding back any vintages in bottle, and is that something that people do? Do you know anyone that's collecting them, or do mostly people drink them, not Horst?
So typically we'll have people who have friends that aren't necessarily beer drinkers come with them just so they can get more than the two bottles. I gather on the secondary market.
This is like the sneaker business in New York City, right?
Yeah, it's a sight to behold, and you know, I'm on the fence of how I feel about it, but people will use it as bargaining chips to trade for other beer. As long as you know you're not trying to, you know, make money off of it, selling it online, which unfortunately people have done in the past with Kate the Greats. But you know, it's something that I think is deservedly well sought after, and you know, having as many bottles kind of to stick around and enjoy in increments, you know, I always...
Okay, so what is someone... Okay, think about trading. I'm trading a Montelesser for a Westfleterian.
For a Westfleterian.
Is that an equal trade?
I think so, yes.
And then what about... Has anyone ever offered to trade a Montelesser for a new car?
Not yet, but I would partake in that trade.
Might happen. So, and Horst, you said you've been actually collecting. How many vintages of these Imperial Stouts do you have?
Several in a particular cooler in the basement where I keep my white wine.
And what is your goal as a beer expert and knowledgeable person? What would you like to do? I mean, we're almost done with the show, but sure. It's great to talk to Horst. Horst knows. You're collecting these beers. What are you going to do with them? And what does it mean to you as a knowledgeable person?
Okay. I hope I'm not off base here. As you know, the alcohol, the ethanol in beer becomes aldehyde as the beer ages, and it tastes like cardboard. If the beer is high gravity and made the way this is with very little oxygen in it, the oxygen is all gone, that staling process is arrested. And that means the beer mellows, like almost like a great red wine. And that's how I look at it. And eventually it will be over the hill, maybe in 10 years or in 8 years. I haven't pushed it that far yet. The taste experience of an extremely well mellowed beer will be very different from a fresh beer, even a heavy, a high gravity, very complex beer that is saturated with all kinds of Madeira and port wine flavors and oak tannins and so on.
So maybe next year we can taste a few of the different vintages, right?
There you go.
Yeah. All right. And Woody, this must be exciting for you. But like I said, so much beer that I drink, walking in today, my new favorite's the Pilsner. I mean, I've had the Pale Ale a lot, but I feel like I'm just want to drink good beers, and I'm really happy to be in your brewery and your tasting room and the environment here, and it's not a mega beer hall. This is a very intimate space that just feels right. So you guys are doing a great job here. I know your mom's part of that too. Anything else you want to say about Tributary Brewing? And now you kind of life is into this now. You're working hard, and I'm really glad you invited me up. Thank you so much.
Well, Jimmy, it's been a pleasure to have you, and I'm looking forward to going out and having some oysters with you after this. I think if I could leave off anywhere, it would just be that I want to be appreciative for, you know, those brewers that came before me, you know, for generations. You know, I hope in talking to me and Horst, you can realize that we both enjoy the history side of it, and just kind of looking at the marvels of industrialization and how that really changed the face of beer and kind of got us to this point. You know, Tributary, we focus on tradition. We do take opportunities to kind of use traditional means to express ourselves in a ever-changing brewing, field of people are want to get out there and to enjoy. Sorry for fumbling over words, but you know, I just want people to know when they come to Tributary that we pour our hearts and souls into, you know, start to finish, selecting our ingredients, giving the beers the proper time to mature, and you know, you're just gonna have a damn fine beer when you're
here. If you're on that crossroads between
community experience,
Boston and Portland, Maine, Kittery, Maine, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, right in the middle, and I'm having a great time here. I'm gonna stay here. We're gonna hang out. We're gonna go to Row 34 in Portsmouth and have some oysters. But I just want to say thank you guys for having me, and highly recommend that this old salty seaport, Air Force Base, Navy Yard area called Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Is really like one of the feature places of food and drink in New England, right up here at Kittery, Maine, Tributary Brewing. Thanks so much, Horst Thornbush, Woody Mott. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Assassins Radio. And thanks to Armin, our engineer, who's going to be cleaning this up. We will catch you sometime later on Beer Assassins Radio. All right. Woo! Thank you.
Cheers. Woo!
Beer Assassins Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.